Some of you are going to very soon say to yourself, this is not a sermon, this is a history lesson. Very good, you're perceptive. In the last 17 years that I've preached, I've gotten more positive feedback on the lecture that I gave 2 months ago than just about any other sermon I've ever preached. And I thought, what the heck, if people like it, I'll do it again. But really, I'm doing this because I like it. Most of you know that I'm overly educated, and one of my degrees is in church history or historical theology. And so I will try and make this as interesting as I can. It should be interesting in and of itself because of what it is. One of our scripture passages this morning comes from the Gospel of Luke. It's the very first four verses of Luke's Gospel. Luke himself was a physician or a doctor. Luke was a highly educated man who was also a historian. And when Luke approached the life of Jesus, he intentionally tried to write a history, a chronicle in detail of the events. As a result, it's the most detailed gospel. It's also the longest gospel. Here are his opening words. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I have decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. And so Luke emphasizes five things here. One of them is that he is drawing up an account of historical, factual events, things that were handed down to us by eyewitnesses, not myths, not legends, not made-up stories, not exaggerations, but eyewitness testimony. I have carefully investigated everything, and I have written an orderly account in order that you may know with certainty the things that you have been taught. Christianity is an actual, factual faith. It's not made up. It's not what people wanted to believe. It's what actually happened. In the Gospel of John, at the very end of his Gospel, the last two verses, John says this. John is the disciple who testifies to these things, meaning everything that has been written before. I, John, the author, I testify to this. I wrote them down. We know that John's testimony is true. Jesus did many other things as well, John says. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would have been written. John is trying to say, I'm an eyewitness. I've written down eyewitness testimony. Everything I'm telling you is true because Christianity is an actual, factual, historical faith. It's not legends. It's not myths. It's not exaggerations. Well, so what we tend to do, though, is we tend to think, okay, well, the stuff that's in the Bible is all we really need to know, and then what's going on today is all we really need to know. The problem is we skip about 1,900 years in so doing, and there's a whole lot of important things that happened in between, both understanding what it is that the early church believed, protecting what the early church believed, defining and explaining what the early church believed, and getting it all the way to today where we can reject it and say, I don't like that anymore, right? Unfortunately, that's what's happening, is the early church understood that they had the truth, and they protected the truth. They tried to figure out what exactly is the truth, what do we need to pass down to further generations, and then as it comes to our generation, we have an increasing number of people that go, I'm not so comfortable with that. I don't think I need to believe that anymore. I don't even know if it's true. I live in a time and age in which truth isn't truth anymore, and I'm entitled to make up my own beliefs. And so we're at a time when it's more important than perhaps any other time in church history for the church to know what exactly it is that the early church believed and tried to pass down to us. And that's a little bit of what we're going to try and do today and then for a couple of weeks that follow. You have on the inside of your bulletin this chart. I know some of you look at this and go, ick. Others look at this and go, wow, cool. It's my attempt to try and organize church history into 12 periods. On the way the chart reads is there's a beginning date at the top of each, and then there's a important event at the bottom in a box, and then in between each period are important details or words that you should understand. Here's the first one, what I'm calling the era of the gospel, beginning in 4 BC. Why does the gospel begin in 4 BC? Because Jesus wasn't born in zero. Most of you are aware, I think, by now, that the only actual date we have that relates to Jesus' birth is the death of Herod the Great. Herod's the guy who the Magi came to, and he said, you know, go find out and then come back and talk to me. Well, we know that Herod died in 4 BC because it's in the historical record. So the earliest Jesus could have been born was 4 BC, probably 6 BC, because Herod says, go out and kill all the babies who are 2 years old. So Jesus was probably born in 6 BC. But the church history begins with the birth of Jesus Christ, the incarnation of God in human flesh, and then period number one ends with the death of Christ, but we're going to call it the birth of the church because that's what happened when Jesus died and rose again and ascended into heaven. He trained his disciples, they became apostles, and the church began. And the key event here at that time is the Great Commission. The Great Commission, of course, is in Matthew chapter 28, where Jesus says, go therefore and make disciples among all the nations, baptizing them and teaching them to obey everything that I have taught you. This is the marching orders of the church. It's become less the marching orders of the church today. Unfortunately, all too often the marching orders of the church is I need to feel good about where I'm at and my relationship with God, and my feeling good about things becomes the marching order of the individual. And we've lost the marching order of the church is that we need to get out there with the gospel, because the Great Commission was Jesus' final instruction to us. The second era in church history is what I'm calling the era of the New Testament. After Jesus died and the church was born, up until about 100 AD, I guess with you it's this way, up to 100 AD is when all of the books in the New Testament were written. Paul's books were written first, his letters. Paul's books were written around 50 to 60 AD, and Mark, which was the first gospel, was written about 55. But John, who was the last of the Gospels, who wrote the book of Revelation and 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, his weren't written until between 90 to 100 AD, because he's the girly-looking guy in Da Vinci's picture of the Last Supper. He was the youngest of the disciples, probably 18, when Jesus called him. And during this entire period, the church is founded, the church begins to expand, because they are proclaiming the gospel. Now, one of the single most important things that occurred during the period of the New Testament and the early church is persecution. In fact, some people would say it is the defining context in which the gospel grew and spread. It's one of the reasons why the gospel spread. It's because Jews who became Christians at first didn't see themselves as Christians. The first Jews saw themselves as Jews who just believed that Jesus was the Messiah. So they kept trying to go back to synagogue and say, isn't this great? The Messiah's actually come. And people would go, no, I'm sorry, I don't buy it. Or the religious leaders would go, you shut up, don't talk about that. And they began being hazed at first, and then they began being persecuted and told, don't come to synagogue anymore. People would stop patronizing their business. People would vandalize their property. People would sometimes go to the point of stoning them in public, because this were Jews that were committing blasphemy, and so this was okay. So this escalates over a period of time and becomes worse and worse and worse and worse, and so many of the Jewish Christians left Jerusalem. In fact, they left Israel and started going throughout the Mediterranean, because why would I stay where I'm being persecuted? Now, there's an interesting book that's been written recently, and I say interesting, I mean laughable. The book says, The Myth of Persecution, How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom, by Candida Moss. She is professor of New Testament at the University of Notre Dame, which makes it particularly embarrassing. Here's what you can read on Amazon about this book if you want to buy it. A leading expert on early Christianity, I would question that, reveals how the early church exaggerated, invented, and forged stories of Christian martyrs, and how a dangerous legacy of martyrdom was employed and made up to silence dissent within the church and to encourage a new generation of Christian warriors. Now, according to cherished church tradition and popular belief, before Constantine made Christianity legal, early Christians were systematically persecuted by brutal Roman emperors intent on their destruction. This couldn't be more false. Moss exposes the age of martyrs as a fiction. There was no sustained 300-year-long effort by the Romans to persecute Christians. Instead, these stories were pious exaggerations, highly stylized rewritings of Jewish, Greek, and Roman noble death traditions, and even forgeries designed to make heretics, to expose heretics and to inspire the faithful. And it goes on and on to say some more nonsense. Now, when I read this, it's made me think of a story I love of Abraham Lincoln. He was once having a conversation with somebody about Christianity. And this person was proving intransigent and stubborn, like, you're wrong, what I say is right. And Lincoln says, yes, but it says this in the Bible. And the guy goes, I don't care, it's wrong. So Lincoln says, let's change the playing field here for a second. How many legs does a cow have? Well, I don't know why you're asking that, but four. Well, let's say that we call the tail of the cow a leg. Then how many legs does a cow have? Well, five, I suppose, said the guy. And Lincoln said, no, you're wrong. He still only has four. Just calling a tail a leg doesn't make it a leg. It's really embarrassing in academic studies. Over a certain period of time, you have all the PhD theses that can be written on what's actually known, and you have to always come up with something new in research. So there's this increasing number of idiotic doctoral dissertations being written on the stupidest things because there's nothing left to write anymore on the orthodox truths of Christian faith. Plus, you have people that are in our New Testament scholars that don't even believe in Jesus. Candida Moss doesn't believe that Jesus was God, doesn't believe that Jesus rose from the dead, doesn't believe that Jesus did any of the miracles that were said of him. It would be really bizarre, would it not, to be a professor of New Testament in a Christian university and not believe in Jesus? According to a recent study, guess what percentage of professors in Christian universities don't really believe that Jesus was God or rose from the dead? What percentage do you think? 48%. Is that crazy? So, in 70 AD, in the middle of the New Testament period, the Jewish temple was destroyed. Now, this was a crucial event in the history of the church and in the history of Judaism, because this temple, which had stood for centuries, was absolutely leveled to the ground, except for what's called the Wailing Wall today, by the Romans, who said, we're not putting up with Jewish rebellion anymore. They no longer offered sacrifices after this. Judaism never really recovered. They basically scattered. But what happened is that the Jews blamed this on the Christians. They said, we're being persecuted, we Jews are being persecuted by the Romans because of this Christian nonsense. So they even stepped up persecution of Christians even more. It became more fatal to become a Christian. And so Christians just widely spread more than ever throughout the Mediterranean. Here's the thing about this. If you ask the question, how did Christianity spread? Most historians will tell you because of the persecution that went on in the Holy Land. Because if it was comfortable, if everybody bought into it, if the Jews thought it was great, Christianity never would have had the impetus to go out the way it did. And while I don't think God wanted people to have to die for their faith, God used it in such a way that this is how Christianity made its impact throughout the Roman Empire. Is persecution a good thing? What do you think? It's not a good thing for the person who's being persecuted, unless what it does is it forces the person to take ownership for their faith, to be more sincere about what they believe, to not be a social Christian, to not be a casual Christian. Would you say that a persecuted Christian is one who probably takes their faith more seriously? Believe it. The early church said year after year, persecution is a gift from God, a blessing for the church, to cause believers to be true in their faith and for the church to expand and grow. And they believed that if it weren't for the gift of persecution in the early church, the gospel never would have spread the way that it did. So as Christianity spread throughout the Mediterranean, there became five major centers of Christendom. Obviously, Jerusalem was the first. Antioch up in southern Asia Minor is the second. This is where Paul and Barnabas were commissioned and sent out to on their missionary journeys. Constantinople has also been called what other two names throughout history? Istanbul and what else? Byzantium. So depending upon the period, Constantinople had different names. This is the center over time of the Christian faith in the eastern part of Europe. And in fact, this was the center of the Eastern Orthodox Church. Then there's Rome, and then Alexandria, which is basically where Cairo is today. So these five centers became the centers of Christendom. When Christians began to be persecuted in the synagogues, they formed house churches, and they would meet in homes, as many people as could get in there. And then when they got too many, they would meet in another home until they had multiple homes in a city. And the larger the city, the more number of house churches they had, and elders were responsible for individual churches, but as they had more and more churches, they had super elders, and super elders were called metropolitans, which means an elder responsible for multiple churches, and then when they had multiple metropolitans, they created the bishop. The office of bishop is the overseer over a large number of churches or a region, and throughout most of church history, in the early five centuries of the church, these five bishops of Alexandria, Jerusalem, Antioch, Constantinople, and Rome were the most powerful people in the Christian church, which meant by the years 300 to 400, they were the most powerful people on the face of the earth. So there was war waged in order to get the Pope in Rome, because originally the Pope was just one of the other five guys. And so eventually, the theological war and the military war was waged so that the Pope became the Pope. Okay, so the third era in church history is this, what I'm calling the Universal Catholic Church. And Catholic means what? Two meanings means it's the Roman Catholic Church. What's the other meaning of Catholic? Universal. It means the church everywhere. So this is the era in which the church has spread throughout North Africa, throughout the Middle East, and throughout Southern Europe. It begins 100 AD, which is the end of the New Testament period, and this period ends at 312 at the conversion of the Roman Emperor Constantine. And during this period, what's going on is the church is confronting the world and defending the faith. Persecution continues. In fact, it gets worse in many parts of the Roman Empire. People are martyred for their faith, and the church recognizes who the martyrs are and celebrate their faith. And there are apologists, which are people who publicly defend the Christian faith. So in 312 AD, there is the famous Battle of the Milvian Bridge. Constantine wasn't emperor. He wasn't born emperor. Constantine battled Maxentius on the bridge over the Tiber River outside of Rome. And because he won the battle, he became emperor of the western half of the Roman Empire. We all automatically think, well, there's only one Roman emperor. Well, sometimes there were three, but much of the time there were two, emperor of the west, emperor of the east. He became emperor of the west. And here's what happened. The day before the battle, he had this vision that Sol Invictus, which was the unconquerable sun god, one of the gods the Romans worshipped, up in the sky, there was this cross superimposed over the sun and this inscription that said, by this sign, conquer. So he thought about it and he thought about it and he had every soldier in his army put a cross on their shields and they won the battle the next day and he was convinced that the one true God, the God of his mother had been a Christian and he basically didn't want anything to do with her faith. He believed that this God had brought victory, and so he committed himself to Christianity. Now, there's much speculation as to whether this was just a political decision on his part or whether it was genuine conversion. In any case, the next year, along with the emperor of the eastern half of the Roman Empire, they passed what is called the Edict of Milan. This is the first actual law that required religious toleration in the world. So these two emperors of the Roman Empire said, it's not good for us to persecute people who are Roman citizens who believe different things than other people. And because I'm a Christian, I want to protect Christians. So you can no longer persecute Christians. You could no longer confiscate their property, which is another thing that was commonly happening. If you were a Christian, I'll take your stuff. In fact, if you had confiscated Christian property, you had to give it back. He made Christmas an official holiday of the Roman Emperor and Easter official holidays to go along with other official holidays. And arguably, he did this primarily to promote peace, but we also presume it was because he believed that Christianity was true. So this raises the question, did Christianity become too easy? Because here's what happened. Prior to the Edict of Milan, this is about the percentage of Christians in the Roman Empire. a very, very small percent. But after 312, you can see how this shoots up. It just goes crazy in terms of the number of people that come to Christianity. Now, part of this is because you're now free to talk about Christ. You're now free to worship Christ. And so people feel more comfortable doing it. But so here's how this spread. In the early days, Christianity was just in these dark blue spots. So for 300 years, these were the places where we know Christianity existed. But after the Edict of Milan, it starts exploding throughout northern Africa and throughout the Middle East and throughout southern Europe. So why would Christianity explode just because it becomes legal? Because it's cool to become a Christian now. Because people in power are Christian, and if you're Christian, you get benefits. Because everybody knows Christianity is true, it makes sense. And so everybody jumps on board, and here it becomes the problem. Whereas before, Christian faith was an inch wide but a mile deep, now starting at about 350 AD, Christianity became a mile wide and about an inch deep. So you have an increasing number of people who commit to Christ, but they're not really committed to Christ. That they believe it because everybody else believes it. Persecution requires a person's faith to be deep and genuine and profound, even if there's only very few Christians. But if everybody's doing it, which used to be in the 60s and 70s, remember when we were growing up in the 40s, 50s, and 60s? Those who are that young. That everybody went to church, but nobody could tell you what they believed as a Christian. So what does the gospel mean? Well, I don't know. So what does it mean to be a Christian? Well, I try and be the best person I possibly can. Is that what it means to be a Christian, by the way? So you have this lack of depth in the Christian church. We have a different kind of lack of depth in the Christian church today, but it's not because people don't, because before people went to church, they didn't pay attention and they didn't know what was going on. Today, they just really don't go to church and don't commit their lives to Christ. Okay. Let's see. I'm not sure we can do this. I'll tell you what, let's introduce this subject. So, in 49 AD, we have what is called the Council of Jerusalem. Anybody know where this is in the Bible? Acts 15. So, Paul and Barnabas have been going around on their first missionary journey telling Gentiles about Jesus. And some of them convert to Christ. And Paul says, you don't have to be circumcised. You don't have to observe the law. That's Jewish stuff. Well, this gets back to Jerusalem, and they go, this can't be right. People have to become Jews before they can become Christians. So they need to be circumcised. They need to eat the right food and do all of this stuff. And so this great argument arises. And finally, Peter, who some of you might remember in Acts chapter 11, had this vision of all kinds of unclean animals coming out of heaven in a cloth. And God says, arise, Peter, kill and eat. Arise, Peter, kill and eat. Arise, Peter, kill and eat. It only took him three times to get the point. The point is that don't call unclean that which God has called clean. Gentiles have just as much access to the gospel as do Jews. So Peter stands up at this council and says, look, guys, I've had a conversion experience. I don't think we should require any more of them than we require ourselves. People are saved by grace. Peter, in fact, says, we're testing God by placing on the neck of disciples a yoke that neither we or our ancestors were able to bear. We as Jews couldn't bear the law. Why would we expect Gentiles to bear the law? They just are saved by grace the same as us. So then James, Jesus' brother, who wrote the epistle of James, who's the leader of the church, stands up and says, I'll tell you what, we've all agreed that it's by grace they're saved, but let's send some letters out to the Gentile churches and tell them there's a few other things they need to pay attention to. Do you remember what it was that they told them to do? Abstain from sexual immorality, which continues to plague Christians throughout history. Two, the one that you have a lot of problem with, don't eat meat that's been strangled. I'm kidding. And number three, don't drink blood. What's interesting is that the Christians early on said it was a custom in certain places in the Mediterranean to drink blood because there was nutrition in it. They thought there was life in it, that it was good for them. And Christians who drank wine for communion, they were accused of drinking blood and therefore being cannibals. But Christians didn't drink blood because they believed in the Old Testament law that that was not a good thing. So the only test for membership in the early church in 49 AD became, do you have faith in Jesus Christ as God incarnate, the Son of God in the flesh, who lived and died a human life, who rose again from the dead, and it's by him we receive the gift of salvation. And that became the first major theological battle in the church. Now, this has replayed itself, by the way, throughout history, because I don't know if you remember, if you grew up in the 50s and 60s, it was like, so what does it mean to be a Christian? Well, you need to not dance. You need to, if you're a girl, can't wear pants. What else couldn't you do? What? Couldn't go to drive-in movies, right? Play cards, right. So we're at the opposite of this right now. We're at the stage right now where it's like, hey, do anything you want. Go out, drink, go out and get drunk, sleep around. It doesn't matter, you can still be a Christian. But the church tends to bounce back and forth in this pendulum between, well, you're free to do this, and you become too restrictive. And right in there is the balance that Jesus established for us. We're set free by his death, but set free to live a responsible, responsive life. So let's jump to this. Why does this matter? So this raises the question of why are we even having this conversation today and next week? Because there's nothing new under the sun. Because that which comes around goes around. Because it is amazing the things that the early church had to fight against and deal with, that you would have thought they spent hundreds of years wrestling with this stuff, and then lo and behold, another 100 years later, it rears its ugly head. Are y'all familiar with these groups? These are just five of the groups that have reinvented Jesus in their own image. The Muslims, by the way, believe in Jesus, that he was a prophet, and that he's the one who paved the way for Muhammad to come, but they reinvented Jesus in their own image. Mormons believe that Jesus is the firstborn. By the way, I don't know if you know this, that Mormons believe that Elohim is a celestial God who has endless celestial sex with human women and then produces babies. And so one of the reasons that Mormons produce so many children is that they're bringing as many celestial souls into the earth, and when they're all born as human bodies, then Jesus will come again to recreate the heaven and the earth. Did you know that? Okay, so each of these and hundreds of other beliefs that are marginally Christian take that which the church sweat over and bled over and died over for 500 years to establish. Oh, no, we don't like that anymore. We'll do something different. That's what we're doing. Okay, will you join me in prayer? Father, we thank you so much for your word, because in it you speak to us. In it you speak eternal truth that is just as real and just as applicable to us today as it ever was. But Father, there's a lot that occurred between the writing of the Bible and where we are at this moment today. Much that the church fought for, much that the church explained and defined, and much which we really need to know in order to be faithful protectors and guardians of the truth today. We thank you that throughout church history that there are people who stood up for the faith, people who faced persecution and even martyrdom for the faith, people who knew the truth, who explained the truth, and who stood by the truth when others wanted to go a different direction. Father, may we be that kind of people ourselves. We ask this in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen.